This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents I'll Never Change My Name, an immigrant's American dream from Ukraine to the USA to Dancing with the Stars by Valentin Chmerkovsky. Read by the author.
This book is dedicated to my mother, who made me the man I am today, and to my father for setting an example every single day.
Forward. Hi, I'm Max. Val told me that he's writing a book and asked if I would write a foreword. I knew nothing about what that even means, but obviously I said yes, and have been thinking about it ever since. He semi-insisted that I read a few chapters before writing this, but I declined because while this is one book I myself have been waiting for, I really don't need to read it to know that everyone else definitely should. I can imagine what you're all thinking. Obviously, you're his brother and you should say only nice things, blah, blah, blah. But if you really know me, you'd know how I refer to myself as nothing but a traffic light. I just say it how it is. Val became my brother at age 0, I was only 6, and became my student at around age 10, I was only 16, obviously. So you have to understand that our time spent being brothers was limited to some time before Val's puberty until some time after he turned 25. At that point, he had a talk with me about how he wasn't my student anymore, and that I needed to recognize the grown-ass, accomplished, proud man standing in front of me. I will never forget that day. It's the day Val officially relieved me of my duty. I never asked to be anyone's coach. It just sort of made sense. I would take a lesson for $50 and then teach Val what I had learned. Simple and cost-effective. $50 for a dance lesson at that time for our family was like stabbing yourself in the thigh with a fork. No permanent damage, but it hurts like hell. Again, I know what you're thinking. Okay, Max, that is so dramatic. But I assure you that every immigrant like us at some point had to part ways with $50 for some cha-cha lessons and felt extreme pain, because that was like a tenth of their family's net worth. I was a tough coach. I had very limited time, no finances, and lots of personal crap to deal with because I was still a freaking child myself. But I loved Val so much and with so much passion that I wanted so much good for him. I did my best and coached the shit out of him and his partners. I will let Val tell you about his life as a competitive ballroom dancer, but I will only say that in our debut as a student coach duo, we managed to whoop some serious juvenile Blackpool champion ass. Sorry, Mark Ballas, you know it's all love, but it's also all true. Our parents' favorite saying while we were growing up was, "When we die, you'll only have each other, so you can never fight." And we never fought. I may have one time sort of shoved him, but I wouldn't remember, and I would have to have been super pissed about something because I could never inflict pain on him. We weren't twins, but we were so close that I felt his pain every time he hurt, which happened a lot. I mean, this kid could not stop either falling on his face or getting elbowed in the face or getting his bottom lip stuck in the wheels of a skateboard. I will let that marinate with you for a second, but it really happened. I also always had a near heart attack experience whenever Val and his partners were waiting for a result of a just finished competition. In hindsight, I was a fool because my guy almost never lost. Vicariously through my brother, I too am a multiple time World Ballroom Latin Dance Champion and a whooping 17-time United States National Latin and Ballroom Dance Champion. I too am a concertmeister, violinist in the Manhattan Music Symphonic Orchestra. I too am a poet, a rapper, an amazing point guard with a Sean Marion shot, the bowler with the highest average that one summer, a rock-paper-scissor legend, and an impromptu speech-giving god. But what you will find in the ensuing chapters is that Valentin Alexandrovich Chmerkovsky is also a rare breed of a person due to an almost magical collection of life experiences. I assure you that while you're coming to an end of my foreword, I too am coming to an end of reading it. Probably not my first time either. Half because I'm making sure I don't sound stupid and half because I've probably read a billion forewords by now and just want to compare mine to theirs. LOL. I'm sure Val will be diligent in explaining where our competitive nature and pursuit of perfectionism is coming from. I too am about to turn the page and read something fresh, creative, empowering, educational, without a doubt extremely well written and definitely profound AF. So without further ado, do yourself a favor and listen to this book. P.S. You're welcome. Maxim Chmerkovsky.
I am Valentin Alexandrovich Chmerkovsky. In the summer of 2016, I had just come off a national dance tour and was heading into my 11th season as a professional dancer on the reality TV talent show Dancing with the Stars. The tour took me all over the United States with my older brother Max, the two of us dramatizing the story of our lives. Max and Val Arway told the saga of Chmerkovsky brothers immigrating to the United States from Ukraine and conquering the international world of ballroom dancing. We had written and choreographed the show ourselves, and bringing it to towns in almost every one of the 50 states changed the lives of all of those involved. Max and I celebrated our adopted home of America through imagination and dance, and there was laughter at every performance, and tears too, both on our faces and on the faces we saw out in the audience. We were welcomed beautifully and managed to connect with people from all corners of the country. That summer, politics dominated the American landscape. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders battled it out, and Donald Trump completely turned the political world on its head. Dancing in a show that honored love of our country, told through the eyes of two immigrant brothers from South Brooklyn, I traveled across the heartland during the full heat of the primaries, through the perfect storm of the party conventions, and amid competing barrages of partisan rhetoric. I felt like I was getting a crash course on democracy. As if the news cycle wasn't loaded down enough, there was also the summer of the Rio Olympics. Even there, politics and patriotism entered into the mix. Because of the European migrant crisis, refugee participants were given special status to compete. Some pretty astonishing figures broke through during the Olympiad, and among the most prominent were the U.S. women's gymnastic team, the Final Five, who brought home the team gold and collected a dozen medals in all. They were real-life superheroes. I was going to say they were like Powerpuff Girls on steroids, but in the sports world, maybe that's not the best way to put it. The dance tour I was on with Max took his final bow in San Jose, California. I flew back to the New York area where my parents lived, where I grew up, where I considered my true home to be. A friend of mine used to say that people should either travel the world or live in New York City, because it amounts to the same thing. After 2 months of total immersion in America, the urban streets felt alive and electric, and I just wanted to plug myself in again to the big city vibe. Dancing down the crowded sidewalks of Manhattan, actually, I walk like everyone else. I ducked into a corner bodega for a coffee, the kind that if you order regular, comes with milk and sugar, served in an iconic blue, "We are happy to serve you" cup. The Olympics were winding down by that time, but on the flat screen behind the cash registers, the climactic moments of the women's gymnastics events were playing out. The team that year represented the best of America, the same incredibly diverse country that I had witnessed while on tour. Lori Hernandez, Simone Biles, Gabby Douglas, Ali Raisman, and Madison Cochin offered a rainbow of colors, backgrounds, and styles. They were in the midst of becoming the most dominant Olympic gymnasts ever, a lineup of super athletes that everyone in the politically divided country could get behind. All the customers in the bodega, at least, were behind them, gazing transfixed at the TV screen. I've been a fan of gymnastics, an amateur fan, if you will, my entire life. I glanced up and saw something that immediately caught my eye. A small-statured girl, very young, super charming. Beyond an obvious incredible athleticism, she had a special quality about her, a calmness in the middle of a pressure-packed situation. The hard-to-put-your-finger-on-it essence came through in the way that she handled herself. She wasn't just an Olympic athlete, but a little star. A lot of athletes want to be celebrities, and celebrities were always trying to be athletes, but here was someone who combined the best of both worlds in one compact package. Damn, who's this girl? I thought to myself. She was in the middle of a tumbling routine, and on one of her passes, she did something I thought was pretty amazing. She found the camera. That's how we say it in the biz when someone on TV breaks the fourth wall and looks straight into the lens. It makes for an instant connection. My mentor Mandy Moore, the legendary choreographer, not the pop star, had to work really hard to teach me the mechanics of finding the camera, because the move can easily look crazy and intrusive if overdone or done tastelessly. Well, this girl nailed it perfectly. I vividly remember the moment I fell under her little spell. She stuck the landing, raised her arms, and gave a wild, triumphant smile. From my time on Dancing with the Stars, I knew the ability to find the camera was an essential skill for any performer. And one so young, that move signaled some serious sass, as well as confidence and experience way beyond her years. It was as though she had winked at the whole scene having fun with it. I laughed out loud, shaking my head in appreciation. Who does this little girl think she is? I was blown away. I couldn't hear the commentary because it was a New York corner deli with a lot of noise going on, orders flying back and forth and sirens screaming by outside. But I remember the graphic coming up to identify the athlete. Lauren Hernandez, Old Bridge, New Jersey. I couldn't help it. I called out, "Let's go, Jersey!" New Jersey, my second home state behind New York. I knew Old Bridge, and I had spent my teenage years in Saddlebrook. I felt a swell of pride. I wasn't that deeply familiar with the world of gymnastics, but I had never seen many Hispanics among the ranks. So Lauren, everyone called her Lori, was a revelation in that respect, too. The sassy Puerto Rican girl from New Jersey who could find the camera. Well, all she was missing were the big hoop earrings and her boyfriend's name on her necklace, and she'd be singing, I'm still Lori from the block. All right, Lori Hernandez from Old Bridge, New Jersey, I said to myself. You got my attention, little star. Then I grabbed my coffee, left the store, and didn't think anything more about it. Dancing with the Stars matched professional dancers like me and my brother with celebrity contestants who were singers, actors, media personalities, entertainers, or sports figures. I had only a few days before the scheduled announcement about the couples who would be paired off to compete on season 23 of the show, which would premiere in September. As in the case in real life on Dancing with the Stars, no one tells you beforehand who your partner is going to be. The choice of dance partner had been made for me, and going into the season, I remained in the dark. In the days leading up to the announcement, the buzz among the professional dancers rose to new heights, with multiple texts flying daily, almost hourly. Everybody thought they had the inside scoop. The burning topic. Who was matched with which celebrity contestant? Who do you got? What do you know? I got this person. I heard you got that person. I try to stay out of the crossfire of gossip. I actually didn't want to know who my partner was going to be. I preferred to be truly surprised when the revealing moment was taped, and if I knew beforehand, I would have to fake my reaction. I'd rather be honestly disappointed than be dishonest with how I felt. Whomever she was, I would be spending a very intense 3 months of my life with this person. We would be diving in deep, physically, emotionally, and even, yes, spiritually deep, maybe as deep as two human beings can possibly get over the course of 90 days. Pretty damn deep, let me tell you. The first meeting segments were like mashups of a blind date and an arranged marriage with a little bit of a shotgun wedding thrown in too. Normally they took place in Los Angeles, organized by Dina Katz, the show's casting director, but at times they were shot elsewhere for the convenience of the celebrity involved. The meetings were all done on camera. The producers liked to spring the news on the contestants with the videotape rolling in order to increase the drama. When we were finally introduced to each other, our reactions were shot in close up to be broadcast so that 30 million people could dissect and debate every nuance of the match. What partner I was assigned made all the difference. Would we be simpatico? Was she passionate about dance? Would there be chemistry between us? Season after season, the first meetings made for a crazy, only in show business challenge, but one that kept me coming back to the show every year. Not knowing made the process sweeter and more intriguing to me. So I didn't want to be told, but my dear brother Max was determined to tell me. After more than 20 seasons on Dancing with the Stars, he was totally dialed into all the backstage chatter. Dina gave me an address in New Jersey for my partner's first meet, I told him. New Jersey, really? Hey, I know who you got. Bro, you got matched up with that Muslim chick, the fencer who competed in the Olympics, remember her? She made a big splash by competing in the hijab. I did a quick Google search. Ibtihaj Muhammad, I said, mangling the name as I pronounced it. Yeah, Muhammad, that girl, Max laughed, considering the whole situation to be comical. A Chmerkovsky and a Muhammad doing the salsa, he said, only in Hollywood. Dina took care of casting for the show and wore a lot of other hats too, acting as the liaison between celebrities and dancers whenever friction arose. She was the one who settled the dust and made sure everything ran smoothly. On my way to the meet, she again got on the phone with me. Listen, you're meeting your partner later today and we're really excited. Please call me right afterward and tell me how it goes. Oh, and stop in the parking lot where you can get there and wait for the camera crew because we don't want to ruin the surprise. I followed the GPS directions through the wilds of New Jersey. Just before arriving at the address Dina gave me, I received a text from Sean Johnson, the Olympic gold medalist who had been a winner on season 8 of our show and then returned for season 15. Even though we had never been paired up as dance partners, we built a solid friendship and kept in touch from time to time. Oh my God, I'm so excited. You better be nice to her or I'll kill you. She's like a sister to me. Sean, I texted back, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, hi, how was your summer? I hope you're doing well. Oh my God, you mean you don't know? I'm like, nope. Oh my God, please don't tell Dina. She's gonna kill me. Sean tended to kick off all her texts with, oh my God. I think she had the words programmed into her cell phone, so they just automatically came up. All right, I texted back. I was conflicted. I didn't want to know, but I wanted to know now. I'm not gonna blow the secret, but just tell me who it is. No, I can't, Sean replied. At that moment, I pulled into the parking lot at the address, a huge pole barn-style gym in Monmouth, New Jersey. Max had gotten the sport wrong. It wasn't fencing, it was gymnastics. A big banner hung across the facade of the facility. Congratulations to our Lori Hernandez on her amazing journey in the Olympics. I took out my cell phone and texted a photo of the banner to Dina. Way to be discreet about the whole thing, but I promised to act surprised. That banner might have given me a hard-to-miss hint about who I'd be matched up with that season, but I would still be a surprise to Lori. I had to sit in the parking lot for a half an hour waiting for the crew to mic me up. I thought back to the week before, recalling the epiphany moment in the New York Corner Deli where I saw her for the first time. During the course of the Olympics, Lori Hernandez had become the quintessential American girl. She was America, the way America looked right now. In my eyes, she was the spirit of the new reality in this country, the beautiful one I had encountered in towns all over the United States that summer while on tour with my brother. Lori Hernandez, a new American heroine, or rather a heroine for a new America. I was about to embark on a journey with a superhero, and I thought, damn, that's a huge responsibility. I better do a good job. Lori clearly possessed everything necessary to be a champion. At the same time, she was still young, just turned 16 that summer. She had a maturity about her for sure, but she still displayed a youthful presence. I thought it might be her eyes, so large, so full of energy, brimming with life and curiosity. I would find out that Lori could look down from her towering height of 4'11", or look up rather, and those eyes, man, you would just sink into them. They spoke of innocence yet strength, pure humility through and through. Whenever I encountered a personality like that, I felt an overwhelming sense of wanting the best for the person. I need to help and protect her. I wanted to do all I could do to communicate whatever knowledge I had accumulated to provide her with all the tools from the huge toolkit that by then I'd been lugging around for over 30 years. With every partner I had on Dancing with the Stars, women from varied backgrounds and wildly different paths in life, I tried to discover the overlap in our lives, attempting to plant our shared flag on common ground. What did I have in common with a 16-year-old Hispanic girl from New Jersey? I thought of the journey Lori Hernandez had experienced, breaking into a world that in the past had never welcomed people who looked like her. Gymnastics remained very white, three-quarters white by a recent survey, with Latinos making up less than 4% of all participants. Si Dios lo quiera, to represent the U.S. as the only Latina gymnast would be such an honor. She told the press before the games, I feel like I could be a role model to other Hispanic gymnasts interested in the sport. But I also want them to understand the importance of being focused, determined, and not giving up, despite all the struggles. Lori must have had a hard time busting out of the box people wanted to put her in, perfectly symbolized by the white, black, Hispanic choices on the U.S. Census questionnaires or the SATs. Going through the public school system, I had to fill out similar forms myself with neat boxes for white, Asian, Hispanic, etc. For a long time, I checked other, because as a recent immigrant, that's how I saw myself. I wasn't the white that I thought of as American white. I wasn't black. I wasn't Hispanic. I was an other, an outsider, and maybe Lori felt that same way too. In a lot of ways, she was the most American kid I had ever met. She loved her church, her family, her country, and she served all three very well. As brilliant as her achievements had been, I could hardly imagine the obstacles she overcame along the way. The folks stepping up to tell her that no, little Lori from the block could not possibly do what she dreamed of doing. In the odd way, we seemed to share similar battles of identity. She was a Hernandez, I was a Chmerkovsky, but we had both carried the country's flag with pride, standing on a champion's platform to hear our national anthem. Not the national anthem of dozens of other potential countries that could have had their victories honored, no. It was our anthem, played for the world to hear because of our personal efforts on our country's behalf. Her road to honor was through gymnastics, while mine was by way of championships I won representing my country on the parquet floors of international dance competitions. But that was my past, and presently, I was looking at the future. Dancing with the Stars was a show all about renewal, about busting down barriers, breaking out of assigned roles, forging new identities. Celebrity athletes, singers, and actors who came on weren't known for their dancing ability. They wanted to demonstrate that they weren't just a football player, a pop star, or a face on a hit TV series. They were human beings capable of embracing a lot of different roles and fulfilling themselves as people in a lot of different ways. Over the course of our season together, I would come to find that Lori and I had more in common than people might think. But at that moment in the parking lot, our time on Dancing with the Stars, an intense, wonderful, and rewarding period, still lay ahead of us. The sound tech signaled to me that they were ready to go, so I climbed out of the car and headed in to meet my new dance partner. I thought a lot about my experience with Lori Hernandez recently, because I've been increasingly feeling restless over being labeled, boxed in, and pigeonholed. I might be a Russian immigrant, a Max Schmankowski's little brother, and she might be Lori Hernandez and an Olympic champion, but when we danced, we were just us, just Val and Lori. We blew up the assumptions people made about us, dismantled the boxes they shoved us into, and just generally had a blast, changing the world one dance step at a time. If someone says of me, oh, he's the Dancing with the Stars guy, I have every reason to be proud. I've built a great relationship with the show, a relationship that first of all is about gratitude. It's given me so many friends and so many opportunities that before anything else, I have to say thank you. There's a small voice inside me eager to disagree. Hey, wait, I'm not just the Dancing with the Stars guy. Now that could sound ungrateful, and believe me, I don't mean it in that way. Just like when I hear, oh, that's the dancer dude. Yes, I'm happy for everyone to say that, but there's that same voice that rises up to shout, no, I'm not just a dancer. I'm so many other things, too. I'm a poet, a boxer with a passable left jab, a classical violinist, a killer basketball player who loves hip-hop. I never want to be cornered by a description, never want to be boxed in, limited, defined. I'm proud of the variety, proud of the paradoxes, the weirdness, and the fact that everything I'm not is exactly what makes me who I am. Oh yeah, that guy. He's the ballroom dance guy on TV. When someone labels you, it means that they can stop thinking about you as a human being. That's why I'm writing this book. I want to show you the whole me, the real me, the one beyond all the preconceptions and stereotypes. We've all experienced being labeled and dismissed, and we've all felt the frustration of not being appreciated as a fully rounded, independent individual. Who hasn't peered out at society and muttered, there's more to me than meets the eye? I knew that Lori had told herself that, and then went out and proved it to the world. Whenever someone typecasts me, my first impulse is to shrug it off, not to dwell on it, to keep it moving. In Ukraine, where I spent the first 8 years of my life, I was stereotyped as a Russian, because I spoke the language. But in Russia, I was considered to be Ukrainian because I was born in Odessa. Later on, when I moved to America, Russians judged me as a person who left the home country, while to others, I was stereotyped as a refugee and immigrant. Not Val, not an individual who is complex and who, like all of us, has as many aspects to him as a mirror has mirrors. No, just an immigrant. I am Valentin Alexandrovich Chmerkovsky, and I will never change my name. No matter how many times I say it, Chmerkovsky will never sound less foreign, but that doesn't make me less American. And it definitely doesn't make me less proud to be one. This book is about a different kind of patriotism, the kind that comes from the gratitude of the immigrant who pledged his allegiance to this incredible flag. It's about all the steps I've taken to make it to where I am now, dance steps and other kinds of steps, and all about the connections I've created and bonds that I've forged on and off the dance floor with people who taught me more than I could ever teach them. It's also about the promises that I've made along the way, many of them unspoken. Pledges to family, teachers, mentors, and friends that their efforts on my behalf would never be taken for granted. So that's the journey I invite you to take with me in this book. We'll erase a few labels, explode some boxes, and have some fun in the process. With stories of love and family, and with insights such as how pride ultimately saved my life, I'll seek to inspire you by showing how I was inspired. It's a journey of fulfillment, exploration, and celebration. It just might help you on your own journey, or at the very least entertain you along the way. Come dance with me. Part 1. A Journey in Dance. Hashtag DWTS. In the summer of 2005, when the first season of Dancing with the Stars dropped, I remember that my initial reaction was simple and immediate. I rejected the whole idea. The formula of pairing professional dancers with celebrity partners, which was imported from a British program called Strictly Come Dancing, struck me as gimmicky and false. I feared the new show would do damage to the ballroom dance world that I loved, but which had always struggled with being taken seriously. Ballroom wasn't a goof for me. It wasn't a game. I had been at it practically my whole life, and the art form as I knew it was as deep and powerful as that of more prestigious forms such as ballet, painting, sculpture, and drama. I had also been trained as a classical violinist, so I understood the aesthetic possibilities of a Mozart sonata, say, when compared with a finely executed Paso Doble, and I knew they could both tap into passion and humanity at the very highest levels. Purely on a physical basis, I also knew the kind of dancing I was doing was an athletic activity as demanding and as intense as anything else out there. All the common elements of athletics were present in ballroom. Requirements of skill, competition, and fitness, as well as the real possibility of injury. Over the years, an alliance of dance organizations lobbied to get our competitions officially classified as a sport. I was part of that movement, which rebranded ballroom as dance sport. My dad, my brother, and I helped in the push to get dance sport into the Olympics. That was the level of respect I thought it deserved. By no means was I revolutionary, but when it came to dance sport, my family and I were certainly among the founding fathers in this country. We felt the combination of aesthetics and athletics was precisely what made ballroom dance special and exciting. In figure skating, perhaps, or ballet, you had a similar kind of artistic physicality, but ballroom enjoyed nowhere near a status comparable to those disciplines. Meanwhile, rhythmic gymnastics had been in the Olympics since 1984. My father saw his sons as athletes first and artists second. Matching dance professionals with celebrities, somehow it didn't ring true. I doubt if anybody ever considered doing a show with Michael Jordan teaching Michael Jackson how to do a layup. As a small community on the rise, ballroom dancers worked hard to give our art form a better reputation. Within that context, Dancing with the Stars seemed a little like selling out. In the summer of 2005, I had just turned 19, and you have to understand where my mind was at that point in time. With my partner Valeria Kozhirinova, I was dancing in ballroom competitions at national and international meets, and we were absolutely killing it. We had just won at the Blackpool Dance Festival, which was the oldest and in some ways the most prestigious ballroom competition on the international circuit, our version of Wimbledon. We also landed in the semifinals of the World Amateur Latin Dance Championships, and we were winning everything in the States that we could possibly win. On the business front, too, the various Chmerkovsky family enterprises were booming. There were four of us, me, Max, and our parents. Our Rising Stars Dance Academy maintained its standing as the top children's dance studio in America. the dance competition we hosted in Brooklyn, the Grand Dance Sport Cup, was fast becoming the premier competition on the youth dance sport scene. Finally, our chain of Dance With Me studios, which was just starting up at the time, looked to be a wave of the future, both for the family and for the dance world in general. Right from the start, our Dance With Me social dance schools offered the best of both worlds, featuring the heart of a family business combined with the execution of a Fortune 500 company. Under my father's leadership and an alliance with a powerhouse businesswoman named Jana Volanets, Dance With Me was proving to be ragingly successful, helping to put our family on a firm financial footing for the first time since we had arrived in America a decade before. With all this happening, why would we bother ourselves with an upstart reality TV show on the West Coast? We were fighting the good fight on our own. We were too proud and too busy to drop everything in order to babysit celebrities in Hollywood. But there was someone in our family who might have benefited from a little away time. During this period, my brother Max appeared sullen and exhausted. He had to watch from the sidelines as a partner he had declined to dance with, Joanna Lunas from Belgium, rose to the top of the ballroom world. She had completely changed the life of the man she wound up dancing with, making Michael Malitovsky one of the leading dancers in the world and winning the World Latin Dance Championship with him. That could have been Max. His opportunities with other partners dwindled away. My brother played all this over in his mind, not feeling a great sense of regret necessarily, but definitely questioning where his life was headed. Such was the situation within the Chmerkovsky family that summer when the telephone rang. Hello? Hollywood calling. They reached out to my brother first. Hey, Maxim Alexandrovich, come on down. It was like an invitation on The Price is Right, a game show that was actually taped on the same lot as Dancing with the Stars. Later on, my parking spot at the studio would be two slots away from Drew Carey's. A gig on a popular TV talent show offered Max an opportunity to shake off the blues, change his environment, knock down a solid paycheck, leave behind the responsibilities that had boxed him in for so long as a dance instructor and provider for the family. In short, he would be able to get away from the headaches plaguing him in our home base of New Jersey. So of course he said no. From his perspective, the decision was a no-brainer. Naturally, he was going to turn down a project that paired up dance professionals with celebrities because it might make a mockery of all that we had invested our energies promoting. He would not go to Hollywood just for a bigger paycheck and a bigger audience. That's the kind of move the Chmerkovsky family considered a compromise, and we weren't going to do that. So thank you, but no thank you. We're flattered, but we'd rather starve than eat a 5-course meal on our knees. Righteous? Yeah, right. Righteously idiotic, but very Chmerkovsky-like. We thought we knew what we were giving up and believed in our hearts that we were making the right choice. I remember going over to a friend's house on June 1st, 2005 and watching the first episode of Dancing with the Stars airing back then on Wednesdays on ABC at 9 o'clock. I was a boxing fan, and as I watched former heavyweight champion Evander Holyfield massacre a foxtrot, I almost had to cover my eyes. The survivor of the infamous bite fight against Mike Tyson barely survived with his dignity intact. He left the show with no bite marks, but potentially with a bruised ego. I shouldn't be too tough on Evander, though, because I found out later that he was the reason Dancing with the Stars wound up on the air in the first place. At the last minute, at the very last minute, according to what I've been told, Evander signed on and ABC gave the program the green light. If Evander had said no to the show, I'd still be back in Saddlebrook right now, teaching kids how to do the cha-cha-cha. There were only 6 couples in the competition that first ramshackle season, with soap star Kelly Monaco teamed up with a Belarusian-born dancer Alek Maza to win the first Mirror Bowl trophy. While there was some great dancing on the show, watching back then, I wasn't too impressed overall. I was still immersed in the more serious world of dance competition. As far as I was concerned, ballroom dancing was a respectable sport, not something for the entire world to giggle about, witnessing some punch-drunk, one-eared palooka stumble around the floor. Firmly seated upon my high horse, I could do nothing but look down on this new entry onto the ballroom stage. In retrospect, my reaction seems a little ridiculous. But we as a family made our decisions on an idealistic basis rather than on a cool-headed cost-benefit analysis, and that strategy had always served us well. At least we thought. People were always tugging on my father's sleeves with opportunities, wanting to use our success to further theirs. Dancing with the Stars represented only a minor blip on the radar screen. We were right to turn our backs on it, weren't we? How were we to know that this little reality TV import from Britain would blow up to be one of the biggest phenomena in American entertainment? Success changes everything, and success in America, the land of success, sends an especially powerful message. Whatever the highfalutin, high-flying Chmerkovsky brothers thought about the show, the rest of the country embraced it with full-hearted enthusiasm. The finale that first season brought in 22 million viewers, an incredible number for a broadcast television program that was just starting out. Suddenly, the picture swam into sharper focus. Did the Dancing with the Stars producers hold it against my brother for refusing them the first time around? Oh, when we were nothing but a summer replacement show, you turned up your nose. But now, when our viewership is in the millions, you want to change your mind. No, the showrunners weren't proud. They again invited my brother to come onto the show as a professional in season two. "Hey, Max," said the producer on the other end of the phone call. "We're interested in casting you for the second season. It's going to be a 10-week gig this time around. Here's the pay." Insert the sound of a ringing cash register here. "We will put you up. We'll take care of everything for you. We're very interested in having you participate on our show." I would love to say that my brother politely declined, but his response wasn't as polite as you would probably think. Right at that moment, we had a lot on our plate, operating both Rising Stars Dance Academy and our chain of Dance With Me studios. We had entered into the world of promoting ballroom dancing to an older generation, a nostalgic generation, people who could benefit from physical, therapeutic, and a mental perspective. "Treat yourself to a dance lesson," was our message. Strangely enough, we didn't put two and two together right away. We failed to realize that the people we were trying to reach with our Dance With Me promotions were the same people who watched Dancing with the Stars. Synergy wasn't a word that occurred to us. But what did mean something was that our beloved Max remained down in the dumps. It didn't make sense to us that he'd decline a chance for a fresh start on a hit Hollywood show, doing what he'd done at the highest level in competition. Seen from that perspective, Dancing with the Stars was a natural fit for Max. My father, mother, and I got together and staged something like an intervention. We didn't call it that, but that's what it was, because we were trying to blast Max out of his funk. "Max, you gotta do it," I said. "You gotta go out there, you gotta try this. Switch it up a little, you know? You only have to do one season. You make a little money, enjoy a little bit of LA, experience a change of scenery, then you could turn around and come back home, you know? No one will hold you hostage out there in Hollywood, will they?" asked my mother in Russian. "If the television show is not for you, then you do some other thing." "Yes, you could always come back," my dad added. "You could come back and continue to dance in competition, but for now, you don't have a partner, am I right?" "It's only 3 months," I reminded him. "Actually, 2 months, or 2.5. Not really realizing the impact it would have on our lives, the three of us kicked Max out the door, onto the plane, and into a role on Dancing with the Stars. The move would come back to haunt us, because it immediately became clear that Rising Stars Dance Academy, for one, would never be the same without Max as head instructor. He was the heart of that studio, with my father acting as the brain and me and the other student dancers serving as the soul. I would take over the lead instructor's role as best as I could, but Max leaving for the West Coast would have serious repercussions for all the Chmerkovsky family enterprises. My brother went out to LA and a star was born. He came, he danced, he conquered. In the winter of 2006, performing on season 2 of Dancing with the Stars, Max demonstrated that he had the ballroom chops for sure, but he also exhibited another quality that made him a vital addition to the show's cast of professionals, a ready-made masculine image that translated very well on TV. Ladies and gentlemen, introducing the Russian bad boy of ballroom, Max Chmerkovsky. The cameras loved him. He came across as cool, impossibly handsome, and slightly dangerous, the kind of charismatic figure that viewers could spin fantasies around. Now that we had an excellent reason to, my parents and I tuned in for every episode of the new season. As we watched, we fell in love with the show and came to admire the whole pro-celebrity concept. The production itself smoothed out the first season kinks and became sleeker, better, and more professional. The number of competing couples increased from 6 to 10. The shakedown run was over. ABC had a smash hit on its hands. Sitting in front of the tube in New Jersey, a continent away from the action in LA, I looked on with amazement, pride, and a slight pang of jealousy as my brother came into his own. As a family, we had trouble believing what was happening, because for the first time, our absolutely unpronounceable, ridiculously difficult last name crept into the vocabulary of the average American household. Emergency room visits for sprained tongues increased noticeably. For his first season on the show, Max was paired with actress, singer, and celebrity beauty Tia Carrera. They made for a dazzling couple, combining the exotic and erotic in an explosive mix. When they danced, it was difficult to take your eyes off of them. Tia gave off the vibe of a new, modern kind of woman, eager to regain her pre-maternity form after the recent birth of a child. She just happened to be matched up with a seething, strutting Russian-American stud like a gazelle in the embrace of a panther. Max managed to make a hot show hotter. On Dancing with the Stars, contestants lived with the constant presence of the camera. Early on that season, an incident occurred, caught on camera during rehearsal, that ignited controversy and at the same time cemented Max's badass reputation. Tia had just performed a move that Max had taught her. After completing it, she looked over to her pro teacher in excitement and a sort of girlish pride. "Hey, so how was it?" she asked. Max looked lazily back at her, cynicism in his eyes and tough love in his veins, and with a slight tinge of sarcasm uttered a phrase that would be linked to him forever afterward, helping to define his character on the show. "Well, you know what," he said, "that wasn't disgusting." The odd thing about the whole Tempest in a Teapot affair was that for me and my parents, watching back in Saddlebrook, the moment passed by without us thinking anything of it. We didn't even twitch, because that demeanor, that voice, and that attitude were all eminently familiar to us. But to America at large, Max's behavior was such a shocking revelation, and it lacked political correctness to such a degree that it came off like a slap in the face. He suddenly became Max the Knife, blunt honesty made for great viewing, especially when it was combined with my brother's aesthetic. And of course, his dance aesthetic was absolutely riveting, if I do say so myself. After all, we are related. Along with everyone in Rising Stars Dance Academy, my parents and I understood Max so well, and his cold-hearted approach was so notorious among us that the dismissive offhand comment to Tia seemed to be part of just another day in the life of our favorite dance teacher. But the internet had come into its own at the time, and it didn't take long for us to realize that the rest of the world didn't see Max in the same way that we did. Well, that wasn't disgusting. What? Who in the hell treats a new mother that way? Poor Tia. Some viewers got angry. A few wept tears over the unfairness of it all. Others grasped the real truth of the moment and reacted with comments along the lines of, "If you can't stand the heat, get off the dance floor." The show's website portrayed an audience split fairly evenly between those that were appalled by what they considered to be my brother's vanity and bad manners, and those who applauded his tough love approach to teaching. Those were the days of chat rooms and discussion boards, before Instagram, Snapchat, or Twitter. Commentary about the show was pretty much limited to the ABC website. Visitors to the network's webpage had to choose Dancing with the Stars from the menu of ABC programs, then click on forums to access the discussion boards. Digging into all the commentary from back in New Jersey, when I was still in college, I became aware of my brother's popularity, or rather his notoriety. I felt an overwhelming urge to demonstrate my loyalty. I didn't limit myself to voting either, nor to soliciting votes back home or getting my friends to call. I set up anonymous accounts on the board so I could defend my man. I checked the list of all chats starting up, Invariably, they spelled his name wrong. Max is so rude. Max is hot. Max is an asshole. Whenever Max is an asshole comments started to outweigh Max is so hot comments, I would come up with subject threads to balance the negative with the positive, trying to fit in and not blow my cover. I spelled his name wrong too. Max is so cool. Max is actually really nice. Max is special. Look at this picture of Max with puppies. It's not something I exactly brag about today, but bent over my funky compact computer in New Jersey, I made the effort. I figured it was the least a brother could do. Controversy was TV gold. Controversy brought discussion board attention. Controversy made fans tune in. Love it or hate it, that's just the way things were. So whatever else happened between him and Tia, they were eliminated 6 that season. Max had proved that he was what they used to call a good copy. All this arose from him simply being himself, doing what he had done every day at Rising Stars Dance Academy. But then something occurred to temper the outrage and give the discussion board trolls a deeper understanding of my brother. For each contestant, producers on Dancing with the Stars created a package, short pre-taped pieces about a dancer's background, edited into miniature biographies. A package ran on Max and his activities as a teacher at Rising Stars, showing him interacting with students. The collection of kids came off as absolute darlings, little men and little women who were accomplished pint-sized Terpsichoreans. Now I swore I would never use that comical ancient Greek term for dancer in this book, but there it is. And they charmed the pants off everyone out there in TV land. Oh, maybe the bad boy wasn't so bad after all. Just look at how his kids respect Max and thrive under his guidance. Viewers saw another side of Tia Carrera's tormentor, injecting a little Mother Teresa flavor into the mix. The package effectively rocketed Max to star status, elevating his visibility among the core of dance professionals on the show. He became a force to be reckoned with, not only as a dancer but as a personality, if not as an actual complicated flesh-and-blood human being, which after all might be asking too much for reality TV. The package on the Rising Stars kids lent Max credibility that he wouldn't otherwise have enjoyed. As much of a stud as he was, his arrogance would have never been accepted if viewers hadn't been introduced to his heart, because arrogance without heart is just plain old obnoxious, which couldn't be farther from what the Chmykovsky household was all about. All of a sudden, this brash sex symbol who had been eliciting comments along the lines of, "Who the fuck does this dude think he is?" instead showcased qualities of humility, leadership, and sacrifice. Max's genuine love for his young students was obvious and reciprocated, producing an intense camaraderie that viewers could sense right through the TV screen. That same passion for teaching his students translated to how he taught his partners on the show, a fresh, unique, and above all, genuine approach that people at home wanted to see. I turned 20 that year, aware of a feeling that things were snowballing. Because my brother's life changed, my life changed too. From the enthusiastic viewer response to Max's video package, the producers knew they had tapped into something special. They quickly reached out and asked if a select few students from Rising Stars Dance Academy could come out to California and dance on the show. I made my first appearance on Dancing with the Stars, not as a pro dancer matched with a celebrity contestant, but as one of Max's former pupils. In our little New Jersey studio, the invitation to come on the show hit us like a bomb. We sorted out 3 couples to make the appearance, including me and my partner, the feisty Valeria, plus 4 others. Nicole matched with Boris, and Sergey paired with Michelle. We weren't your typical Hollywood marquee names, but everyone involved had appeared in the package footage, representing the cream of the crop at the dance school. The producers wanted us to come in with our dance numbers all set and ready to go. We got 2 songs, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean and the perennial favorite Mambo No. 5. We prepped routines for each, made recordings of them, and sent the videotapes out to LA so the producers could work out such details as blocking, positioning of the dancers, and camera placement. When it came time to travel, the actual experience took on a slightly surreal flavor. The JFK to LAX flight was in itself a revelation to some of us. Exciting, foreign, and fresh. We came away from the transcontinental journey thinking how immense America really was. Because after 6.5 hours on the plane, it would have made sense to us if we had landed in a different country. What? This is still the USA? The beautiful weather and the overall Southern California vibe sure made it seem as if we had entered into another world. A magical land where a car service picked you up at the airport and whisked through traffic. The producers put us into rooms at a boutique hotel right across from the CBS Television City, the home studio of the show even though it aired on ABC. The studio has a long history, and everything from American Idol to Three's Company and The Twilight Zone have been shot there. The journey from Saddlebrook to West Hollywood ought to be measured in light years. I grabbed onto anything that felt even vaguely familiar to my Brooklyn-raised senses. A block up Fairfax Avenue was Cantor's, the best New York-style deli in Los Angeles. In fact, the whole neighborhood had something of a Jewish atmosphere, with places where I could get a good bagel, the old-fashioned food stalls of the farmer's market, and more sobering, the nearby Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust. We had an early call the next morning. The six of us walked across the street, received our ID badges, and made our way to the soundstage. Suddenly, the exotic vibe of the experience totally dropped away from me, because the pros who were on the set that day were all dancers I knew well, people such as Tony DeVolani, Cheryl Burke, Louis Van Amstel. These were colleagues who had history with me totally outside of any Hollywood bullshit that was going down. Being with them was like slipping into a warm bath of friendship, with my peers celebrating my arrival. I took my rightful place as a member of the extended family of ballroom dance. And of course, Max was there too. As he had been my whole life, my brother bulldozed the path for me to follow on Dancing with the Stars. His presence was a huge blessing, and at the same time something of a minor curse. I felt his love and protection, yeah, but I also saw myself slotted into the kid brother of pigeonhole that even back then was starting to feel confining. I experienced a stab of envy and couldn't wait until I entered that glittering world myself. I glanced around at the lineup of professional dancers, and a childish, petulant voice inside me spoke up. Man, these guys are not even close to my level. But here they are enjoying an incredible level of exposure. More people see them in a single night than have watched me dance during my whole competitive career. What the fuck is that all about? 2 years ago, they might have been ranked maybe 48th in the world while I was there winning every competition. Now I'm coming in as a sideshow? What am I, a worn-out shoe? Etc., etc. It was an exciting time with big changes afoot, and I, too, had to change with my circumstances. When you feel everything around you changing, you have a choice. You either try to cling to what you know best and stay put, or you sense the changing tide, feel the flow, realize the dynamic, and grasp the bigger picture. Then you could begin making decisions to grow and build, and continue your efforts to thrive, to function as an alpha in a new environment. Keep it moving. Was always a phrase I kept foremost in my mind. I started to make adjustments starting from the first guest appearance in season 2. The key to my success on Dancing with the Stars was not my brother's advice, not anyone else's advice, not my dancing ability or competitive experience, not my looks, though all that helped. I made a simple but crucial decision early on. The tool that helped most on the show was my ability to see myself as a student, and have a complete lack of self-consciousness about it. I've been a student my whole life, from violin, poetry, and dance to plain old-fashioned education in school. I loved learning. My previous experience in ballroom taught me to check my ego at the door, and also allowed me to feel comfortable on the set. I kept myself open, and thankfully was secure enough that pride didn't prevent me from being schooled in the finer points of producing great content. I was able to say, look, I don't know anything about this business of staging dance on television, but I'm ready, I'm willing, and I'm able to learn. My appreciative attitude toward those able to teach me went a long way to helping me fit in. I was impressed, but I wasn't intimidated. As I stepped on stage at Television City, of course I was somewhat nervous, but by that time I had a ridiculous amount of experience performing. though obviously none of the competitions could compete with a $1 million production in the heart of Hollywood, but certainly the nerves I had going into my debut appearance on Dancing with the Stars didn't come close to the nerves I felt at a world championship or a Black Bull championship or even the Russian restaurants on Brighton Beach where I performed when I was 13. I'd been tested. I had endured my trial runs already. So for me, the main emotion was not nervousness, but excitement. The brighter the spotlight, I told myself, the brighter I'll shine. I felt completely at home on that stage in West Hollywood. Mostly, I simply enjoyed the time spent with my friends dancing before an audience of millions. Among those in the audience were two people who would change our lives. The actor George Hamilton, he of the perpetual tan, competed on Dancing with the Stars that season, paired with a professional dancer who I knew well, Edita Slavinska. Hamilton was dear friends with Steve and Elaine Wynn, the casino moguls who together have founded an empire based on real estate, hotels, fine art collecting, and gambling. The Wynns watched the show to root for their friend George, and Elaine especially was charmed by the package on Max and the kids from Rising Stars. Like a lot of people, she was inspired. But unlike a lot of people, she had plenty of resources to act on her inspiration. After she saw the troupe perform, she reached out to my brother. We have a charity event coming up in New York City at the Sotheby's Auction House, and we'd love to have your kids dance. Perhaps something like a 30-minute number? Of course we said yes. We put a show together and had our whole fam at the event, performing for an audience of heavy hitters. Not only the Wynns, but Italian fashion designer Roberto Cavalli was there, and Donald Trump, then just a real estate magnate. Steve Wynn fell in love, just as his wife had. They ended up hiring us to do the New Year's Eve showcases at the Wynn casinos in Las Vegas for the next 3 years. The Rising Stars troupe swelled in number. New Jerseyans, Cole Mills from Oceanside, Kiki Nemchik from Teaneck, Vlad Kvartan from Fairlawn, whose immigrant status was an open question, all got put up in luxury rooms at the Wynn Las Vegas. They did charity events and met such humble folks as Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. The cherry on top of the sundae was when Steve hired the whole troupe for the 2006 grand opening of Wynn Macau, a new casino on the southern coast of China. The Rising Stars kids from Saddlebrook, New Jersey, were the whole show. Wynn flew 50 teenage dancers from New York to Hong fucking Kong. These kids had never seen anything like it. The closest these kids might have gotten to China was an order of sesame chicken at their local Chinese takeout. And by the way, they would be highly disappointed to discover that the dish wasn't normally offered in the actual nation of China. During this period, having Max in my corner meant everything to me. No longer forced to put up with the misery of being broke, working his butt off and being only poorly compensated, he could now afford to toss a few coins my way. Because I was still a broke-ass dancer scratching out an existence in the competition world, I appreciated the favor. More impressive than the money, though, was having doors open to him in the incredible, weird, over-the-top Vanity Fair of show business. Max was 26 years old, a stud, and on the biggest TV show in the country. He ran through Hollywood like a kid through a candy store. Dancing with the Stars had suddenly blown up into such a huge phenomenon that when Max showed up at a party, he was bigger than half, maybe 90% of the celebs in attendance. Man, it was a crazy time. Overnight, my brother went from being a fucking nobody ballroom dancer in New Jersey to becoming the hot new face in entertainment. Everybody wanted a piece of him. Through all of this, I experienced the first small beginnings of an upheaval in my relationship with my brother. It was nothing too pronounced, but I could feel a tremor as the earth shifted beneath our feet. Max and I were now living a continent apart. He had always been my rock, and the thing about a rock, it isn't supposed to change. I was so busy changing myself that I never stopped to imagine that my brother could become someone different than the person who had been at my side for so many years. At that point, I was only faintly aware of what was starting to happen. But the real sea change would wash over our lives soon enough. First season. It took me a while to join the cast of Dancing with the Stars. I had a couple of appearances here and there, some more memorable than others. but I was in my own world and had my own thing going on. Though the show became a huge phenomenon, it wasn't central to my life, since I was heavily involved in the world of ballroom dance competition, and that's where my focus was. But it was a treat to get away and spend some time in this weird, wonderful